The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. Today, I have back with me Dr. Chance Nicholson. Dr. Nicholson joined the Nell Hodgkin Woodruff School of Nursing as an assistant professor in August 2019. He received his PhD from the University of Alabama at Birmingham with a focus on psychophysiological correlations between the vagus nerve's cholinergic pathway, psychiatric comorbidities, and HIV-associated neurocognitive disorders. Dr. Nicholson's research interests and publications center on neurophysiological substrates that form the basis of cognitive behavioral symptoms often observed in trauma-based disorders, in particular post-traumatic stress disorder and borderline personality disorder. And today we're going to talk about a fascinating concept of our self-regulatory behaviors, how some of the behaviors we do that we're unaware of influence our mental state and vice versa. Chance, thank you so much for joining us again.
It was always a pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, so it's really fascinating that we do things without being aware. For example, the posture we may hold in a stressful situation or some action or body language that we do in a stressful situation. And then how that physical activity, how our body then shapes how our mind acts in that certain situation. You know, we always think of the mind dictating the body and the mind controlling our thoughts. And this is a little different because our body also seems to have a heavy influence on how the mind operates.
Yeah. So, and to further that, motor and spatial awareness is actually one of the base points, for higher ordered cognition. So, one of the first ways that infants interact with the world before they maybe can communicate is obviously through touch. You know, they feel everything to try to get some awareness, some discrimination of what textures, are. What does this feel like? What does that feel like? And you interact with it, in terms of learning. The thing is, we tend to talk about sort of regulation in the context of stress, and really this starts kind of at an early age. One good example may be that anyone that has an infant that is, maybe watch them on the little baby cams or whatever, if you'll notice sometimes they may bump their heads against the crib, or they may kind of rock on their own. And what they're doing is they're actually regulating via their vestibular system. And, if you rock sort of in this specific motion, we know how we get motion sickness. So it's the same kind of thing. But you're basically, taking your actions, you're then coordinating with the vestibular system. And then if you're rocking or hitting your head on something, you actually really kind of ends up creating kind of this restful state. And again, you can kind of look at it, maybe another side where it's, a person that maybe is not able to regulate in the most healthy of ways. So persons with autism, when they exist kind of more on the extreme spectrum of that, they may bite themselves when they get upset. They may hit their heads against a wall. And the reason for that would be not all that different than the reason why an infant may be doing it is they may or may not be able to communicate exactly what's going on in their environment. They may not be able to process the sensory information in a way that they can actually reconcile or synchronize, and this is the only way that they can do it. And so by biting, say, their arm, in autism, you notice sort of this hyper-excitability of glutamate, say, in this case, in certain places. Well, if they bite their arm, they're actually moving a lot of the blood flow and a lot of the activity away from that kind of disordered domain or that disordered activity, and they bring it down into more sort of basal mechanisms, things that are less likely to be vulnerable to disruption, because if they were disrupted, a person may or may not have lived very long. So it kind of moves things back into the brainstem, the cerebellum, the pons, trying to get activity kind of as lower ordered as possible so that they can kind of regulate the situation as much as they can. And, you know, it's interesting. We all participate in this kind of behavior. And so an example, two things. One is there's an interesting thing about persons that are blind that a lot of them will gesticulate, you know, and we've always assumed that gesticulation was a way to convey a point or a way to kind of add some quality to, you know, whatever we're saying, you know, give some direction to it. And we thought it was kind of, you know, social. But if it is purely a social thing or a way for us to make kind of a visual point, then it really wouldn't make a lot of sense for a person that was blind to rely on gesticulation, because they wouldn't know necessarily how other people were gesticulating. They wouldn't know what to gesticulate to further their point for in the visual way, right? And it's very interesting that they will still gesticulate. So there's a way of sort of occupying and a way of learning and a way of interacting even when there's not necessarily something tangible, not necessarily something that will give immediate feedback. It is a spatial interaction. If you get persons to read material, you know, say a page long passage of something, if you get one group to just learn as they would normally and you get another group to sit on their hands while they're reading, you actually see that they're able to retain far less, because they couldn't move. They were kind of restricted in this point. So movement, postures, the way in which we interact is actually a major point of how we learn and navigate and how we regulate.
So this is really such an interesting point, because you just gave, you know, some really great examples of how we almost instinctively mm-hmm. do certain, you know, actions, and how that is how we are internally, you know, regulating our mind. Mm-hmm. And so whether, you know, if we go back to the baby, you know, it's so fascinating that we know this in an infant form, you know, that we can, for example, bang our head against the wall, that we've already figured out that this particular activity can, you know, meet a certain need that their body has at a given mm-hmm. moment and soothe them in a way that is what they need. And what's so interesting is, you know, I think of, you know, just being an adult, we seem to have lost our ability to figure out how to soothe ourselves. You know, we're almost not as good as infants, or even in the example you gave of a person being autistic and biting themselves, they're figuring out what they need to do to soothe their self and their mind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seems instinctive that we maybe, you know, lose part of that and have to relearn it. And the interesting part is in our conversation of, okay, if we're adults, how do we learn some of these soothing techniques? Like, these are things that regulate, as you said, whether, you know, it's in a spatial spectrum, whether it's in movement, it's in posture. Our minds are really being directed by our bodies in these situations in a way that is helping us regulate our minds better.
Right. And if you take, I mean, and so we'll use a clinical case, and then I'm gonna pivot to what you were saying. But, you know, persons with chronic pain, persons that maybe have, for whatever reason, maybe they've had a limb amputated, or maybe they're for whatever reason that they exist in a pain state that has limited something that kind of belonged, you know, to maybe a regulating thing. So our arms, our hands, you know, our hands, our lips are the biggest zones of sensory information, right? So if I were to not be able to move my arm, or maybe not be able to do certain things by dint of that, well, then we actually notice in some cases where there's actually cognitive declines and depression, because if the person's in constant pain, then everything that I'm going to be doing is going to be in the context of that pain. So every movement I'm making, every decision I'm making is going to be not to aggravate it to a point of causing any type of acute stress. So it changes my entire interaction. It changes the way in which my brain behaves. And that is something that we don't even recognize, but as our body using pain the way it's supposed to and using it as a learning a sense or you know, what learning information source. But when it becomes chronic, then our bodies, our brain changes its behavior to account for this pain now. So in that way, it kind of has a negative return, because now you know, we're having to figure out a different way to interact with the world, and that way has to be in the context of being aware of that pain. But being aware of that pain is actually very hard for us, because then we feel that pain and we have to sit with the feelings of how this actually hurts. So what our brain does, and we talked about in one of the previous podcasts in terms of heart rate variability or stress, is that the increased stress will actually create kind of a higher opportunity for systole or parasympathetic activity, and that reduces pain. So they'll stay in kind of this hyper sympathetic prime state, and that will reduce pain, but that also then creates, you know, different regulation or dysregulations on the other end of things. So if I have high blood pressure, I might not be able to exercise, right? So, I mean, there's trade-offs in how we interact with the world and how our brains and bodies are going to determine the best solution. So for we talked about the baby, if that's the tool set that it has now. Hopefully, as it gets older and it's able to communicate, it's able to interact with more in the world, it can figure out that I really don't have to maybe bang my head in order to regulate whatever it is I'm trying to regulate, in this case, sleep, right? And you talk about, as we get older, that we kind of lose this kind of sensibility for this. And I think it's, in certain ways, it's necessary, because we deal with so much information, so much stress by dint of phones, televisions, the stress of our job. So we can't attend to everything. So our brain may make a decision to automate the things that are already automated, right? I know that I can assume, at least, that my heart is going to be beating, so it doesn't make sense for me to pay attention to it. But my not paying attention to it may make me unaware of some preemptive physiological response to a stress, meaning that it's going to tell me that something's wrong before it's going to come to my conscious awareness. So me being in tune with my heart, knowing how fast it's going, my sweat levels, my posture, is actually the quickest way for me to maybe be able to predict something bad's going to happen, so I can do something about it before it reaches a stress threshold that forces me to just act or react, instead of being able to kind of, you know, think through it. So again, as a norm, we couldn't focus on our heart rate or our breathing, because it's just occupying our bandwidth when we want to be putting it somewhere else. So, but that's a trade-off. You know, in order for us to be able to maybe regulate our stress a bit better, one of the things that's getting a lot of attention now in research is something called interoception. And this is kind of your awareness of your basically sensory system, you know, what your body's doing, kind of the visceral communication it's having. Again, your GI system, your respiratory system, your heart rate, and some of the things they do to try to figure out kind of what your overall awareness of your body is they have you count your heartbeats. And counting the heartbeats is a way to measure interoceptive accuracy. So persons that actually are highly anxious are really hyper. They have hyper interoception. They are far more exaggeratively aware of their heart racing and their breaths. And that's what causes them to kind of go into this kind of panic, this worry mode, is because they are intimately aware that they're breathing heavy, that their heart is racing. You take it to the other side, a person who maybe is recovering or that is majorly depressed. They have hypo interoception. It's too much stress on them to really worry about what my body's telling me, because my whole body is in kind of this recovery state, kind of this, you know, maybe pro-inflammatory, maybe anti-inflammatory, but there's a lot of signals that my body's having to attend to. So they actually, you know, would not be able to kind of, from a top-down way, focus on their heartbeats or focus on their breath. Because again, that's real estate that doesn't really make any sense in terms of stress allocation. And so that's, again, kind of one way that you kind of see interoception or lack thereof kind of show up.
You know, when you bring this, you know, example of interoception awareness of our heart rate and counting it, it makes me think, you know, what are ways as adults we can use interoception or awareness of our body to work through high stress situations in a more effective way?
So here's maybe a couple of different things that we can use, and this will piggyback on maybe one of our previous podcasts. So one thing that we can do is, again, we can practice by counting kind of our heartbeats. We can kind of, you know, just try to get an idea. And this is where maybe something like a heart rate variability device is helpful, or something that measures heart rate. And you can blind yourself from it and then get it to record it. But then you can count it to see how accurate you were. And the more accurate you are, the better interoception you have, the more generally, the more in tune you are maybe with kind of your body's kind of status. Same thing with breath. They use pain. They'll use certain types of pain thresholds. People who are able to discriminate pain correctly is one way to kind of determine sort of interoception awareness. Person who's highly stressed will not be able to discriminate what type of pain it is, if it's thermal. Well, what specific thing is causing the pain? They're just going to register the pain. There's certain ways that you can actually drink water that will distend your GI system. And there's certain people that will drink way more water than they're supposed to because they're not interoceptively aware of kind of their bladder, their stomach, their fullness, so to speak. And this may occur in things like eating disorders and things like that. In fact, persons with schizophrenia, there's a kind of an unusual phenomenon where they will hyperhydrate. And part of that could be to kind of remove medications if they're taking it, or if they're paranoid about something that maybe someone had given them. But the other part is that if you have gastric distension and bladder distension, you will actually kick in to a parasympathetic state. And these individuals are persons that tend to kind of operate in that sympathetic, kind of chronically primed sympathetic state. And then there's things like the community resiliency model that kind of practices kind of the here and now kind of way of maybe bringing your attention to kind of your body. And one of the things that they teach from is they get you to visualize your hand, and they kind of talk about the different brain areas. And the use of the hand is something that's actually, from my understanding, was kind of by accident from Elaine Miller-Karas. She just used the hand because it was the best tool, again, to kind of visualize and represent. But the hand is one of the biggest sensory systems in the body. It's the way that we interact. So by using the hand, we're automatically going to be more attentive to things that are occurring with our hands, both as a person that's presenting and as an observer. That's why we gesticulate in the other part. We communicate with that. We're going to focus on hands. And then, you know, one of the things they do is have you maybe eat something sweet, and then you begin to describe the taste of that, describe where it goes, how you feel it center into your body. Well, that's a way to get in touch with, you know, what am I eating? Does it actually taste good? Is it actually something that I want to eat? In stress states, when we're trying to regulate, sometimes we'll just eat a lot of high glucose foods, sweets, snacks. And really, if we weren't stressed out, sometimes in our most honest moments, we'll eat maybe McDonald's, maybe a snack. We'll say, it's really not that good. It really didn't taste that good at all. But in the moment when you're stressed, it tastes great. And again, our body, it's interesting because if we were in cold weather, ice cold, if I handed you a glass of ice water, your body's interpretation of drinking that ice water would be much different than if you were in the desert when you were hot and I gave you ice water. You would appreciate and have a lot more reward from that, right? And that is, again, a regulating thing. Your body is saying, you don't want anything else cold. Reject that, or take it in small amounts, versus if you're hot, sweaty, you're losing water maybe because of sweat, and it's cold. Wow, this will really help kind of maybe help regulate your thermal temperature. So we're going to gravitate towards that. And these are obvious examples, but these are things that we do all the time that's kind of automated, that if we pay attention to, we can realize, how do I tend to regulate whenever I'm at my worst or I'm at my most stressed? We were talking earlier, there was a vet that had that but when he got very upset, would become very aggressive, kind of widen posture, squeeze fists together, kind of really signal that something's wrong, and people would become rightfully kind of defensive or kind of scared, kind of back away, which was ultimately part of the PTSD process. But what he started doing was leaning down in his posture. He started kind of making himself smaller. And by making himself smaller, he was actually kicking into a parasympathetic kind of motor. Somatomotory sensory that says, well, if you're crouched down in front of someone and you're in this kind of non-escape, non-fight posture, maybe you're not going to fight. Maybe that's not what we're trying to do. So it kind of gives the body a little extra information, and it kind of uses the body kind of against itself. But if you know that that's something that might be helpful, if you notice that, you know, if you get really angry, sometimes you may curl up in a ball, or maybe you just cower down. If that works for you, well, how can we use that maybe to avoid getting to the point to where you have to do that? You know, how can we use that as a way to maybe throughout the day to be aware of our posture, aware of what we're engaging, the signals that we're giving off that may be able to kind of prevent the situation from getting to the point to where you have to maybe fight or throw something to regulate, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, I was thinking as you were talking. So if our bodies, you know, will naturally assume, for example, a hunched position, or we puff out our chest, and that is really, you know, affecting how we're responding to a situation. As we become more aware, so let's say, you know, for example, as I'm talking now, I'm talking with my hands, and now that you are bringing to my awareness how I'm using my body and paying a lot of attention to now my hands moving as I'm speaking, how do I use this awareness? First of all, what does that mean, and how can I use that awareness to improve, you know, say a stress in a situation, or what I think, do, and say in any situation?
And so again, it's kind of, again, learning your body. So if I can use, again, heart rate variability is kind of what I'm interested in, so I'll use that again, where if you have two individuals who are having a conversation and you're looking at their heart rate variability, then if these are people that know each other and trust each other and the conversation's good, their heart rate variability will actually sync up. They literally at the group level will synchronize. And you can see this in mothers and babies. I mean, we can talk about that. But they synchronize with each other. If there's a conversation going on where one of them is actually in a highly stressed state and one is not, there's less opportunity for maybe them to be able to find some type of alignment. But the person who is not stressed is going to have to work very hard, or maybe extra hard, if they want to stay in the conversation and not have it be stressful. Whereas the person who is stressed really probably doesn't want to work very hard in the conversation because it is too stressful. So what I mean by that is heart rate variability lets us know that in order for us to sometimes have conversations with coworkers for them to be successful or synchronized, that there does have to be some type of give and take in terms of what we're communicating, both verbally and physically. So if someone's trying to have a conversation with you and you're, you know, constantly looking away or disinterested or walking off, well, you're now closing off opportunities to maybe resolve an issue. So knowing that when things get stressful, if your issue is to not deal with it and walk off, well, is that the most effective strategy? And maybe it is. Maybe you're prone to maybe being more reactive, and once you calm down, you can have good conversations. But maybe the walking off is actually having it where the conversation never gets settled, and you're actually finding yourself avoiding maybe this person who's causing problems throughout your workday. Every single day, you just don't want to have to deal with either talking about that conversation or interacting with them because they bother you in such a way. Well, that stress still hangs. It's still sitting there. And a regulating thing is to know your tendencies that are regulatory in a way that are adaptive and that help promote less stress in the future, maybe having that conversation, and the ones that may be more dysregulatory. And that would be not necessarily knowing your tendency in that case, you know, not knowing maybe what you were doing to contribute to the dyssynchrony or to the stress, maybe trying to be aware of what they're doing to contribute, what you're focusing on. Why are you reacting the way that you're reacting? Why is this conversation or this relationship so difficult? And again, how have you regulated in these situations before? Sometimes people will regulate in ways that are less productive. You know, sometimes people will use substances in ways that are you know, deleterious to them. And other people will maybe, again, go take a walk around the building, come back and say, okay, I'm sorry for that, but I do want to continue to have this conversation. I think I realize maybe what I've done. Again, we're talking about communication, but it's also knowing your tendencies, their tendencies, and how do I create a better strategy to not be in the same situation with someone else in the future that the stress remains. Everything's about stress reduction. Everything's about making it predictable. Now I don't have to avoid this person. Now I don't have to worry about that. And we may not notice it, but it takes a toll on us, and it affects our engagement with our work environment. It will sometimes affect the way our engagement, you know, at home is going, and it's dysregulating us, though in the moment, because that was the most stress. We get some reward by leaving in the immediate because, well, at least you're less stressed than you were when you were standing there, and your body says great, so you get a little dopamine boost off actually leaving. But then there's another system that operates behind that that says, but the stress is still there. It's just not as bad as it was in the acute stage. And that stress is what is the problem. That's the thing that contributes to low-grade chronic inflammation if those types of stressors stay on board and they're not dealt with. So you got the immediate reward for running or maybe fighting, but the problem may or may not have been dealt with. And that's something to be, you know, mindful of.
And, you know, one thing that's so fascinating about what you just pointed out is when we become self-aware and we use, say, feedback through heart rate variability to gauge really how well we're self-regulating, you mentioned that we synchronize with those around us or we don't synchronize, mm-hmm. you know, but in a win-win scenario, we synchronize, as you mentioned, mother to baby. How do we do that? How does my heart rate and my heart communicate, say, to your heart? How does that happen?
So if I'm feeling internally stressed maybe about something that's been going on chronically, something that's going on in my environment, and I bring that into a conversation, and if I am interacting with someone who is, you know, maybe doesn't know me quite as well, and again, my body is feeling stressed on the inside, but my external, the things I'm looking at, sort of my extra receptive input says, well, the person I'm talking to seems to be a nice person, but your internal signal is stressed, your heart's racing, you're not noticing kind of this has been going on for quite some time. And so what you do that you don't really realize is you'll begin to try to manipulate the external environment to where maybe it matches your internal environment. So you might say antagonistic things to this person, just if sarcasm, maybe little small jabs, as we might say colloquially, to see if we can get that person to respond in a more defensive, aggressive way. Because now all of a sudden, my internal system was stressed. I didn't know why, and my body's always trying to figure out why I'm stressed. So now I've been able to kind of engineer this person as being that stress. And that's always going to be counterproductive because now the person who you're taking small jabs at, through no awareness of their own, are probably going to begin to posture back in a defensive, reactive way. Their tone is going to change. Their breathing's going to change. Their blood is going to probably flush into their face, into their limbs. And we both as communicators see that. We both notice that. And we don't even realize that we're aware that we know that we see that. And they're doing webcam studies now that are showing just that, which is quite fascinating. And they're also, you know, relatedly, they're also showing that if you create sort of this computer game with a bunch of different people that may or may not look like you, that if you synchronize an avatar's heart rate variability and to yours, you're more likely to pick out that avatar as being more closely related to you. And then if you flip it around and that same avatar, if you end up putting a different heart rate variability, kind of this different or desynchrony, they're less likely to be able to identify them as being part of you. So synchronization and being aware of ourselves in the company of others or group, it's a part of a way that we establish groups. It's a part of a way we establish social belongingness. It's a part of a way that we've always regulated. But now we're at a point to where a lot of times we're overwhelmed with people. We're working in environments with a lot of persons. And so it doesn't make as much sense to spend as much time really focusing on our interactions because we're having so many throughout the day maybe, or we're seeing so many that it's just not worth it. And this is contributing slowly to our stress and our lack of self-awareness. So we need to try to remember that, you know, we are communicating all the time. We are constantly doing things that are giving off signals, usually to avoid stress for the person or to signal that you need to get away from me or this environment or there's going to be a lot more stress. And we all do this every single day. And part of being aware, this is where we talk about interoception, is you should have a fairly good idea if you're walking into a situation that you may not be your best, if your heart is racing and you're sweating, you know, if you can say, wait a minute. Okay, let me ground myself. Let me use some techniques here. Let me concentrate on something I'm eating. Let me concentrate on the rhythm of my breath. Let me do some small activity to try to get in synchrony, maybe walk. And that may be able to have you enter in the room where you're at a closer synchrony to the people in the room. And it's quite interesting because if you can get everyone to do it, one of the things I do at presentations sometimes is tell people something like this, and I try to get everyone kind of on the same page insofar as now we're all focusing on the same thing. Now we're all thinking about our heart rate, And the conversations and presentations tend to go much better because we're actually syncing up, or we're trying to. Everyone's actively participating in being at that same frequency, being at that same level of conversation or level of belongingness in the context. And I don't want to take too much time, but I mean, there's studies emerging now that are showing in mothers with postpartum depression that the ones that are more likely to maybe do something more harmful to their baby are the ones that remain in a more desynchronous state with them. So if you're measuring things like heart rate variability, among other measures, if they're misaligned, the mother is usually the one that's under the stress state. She's less likely to be able to nuance what the baby may want. And she can only really focus on the extreme emotions because they're the most salient. We have a negative heuristic for emotions where we look at the dangerous first. And if there's no alignment, it begins to become that something in the environment is stressing me out. Something here doesn't belong. If it belonged to me, if it was mine, then I wouldn't feel stressed out by it. I should be able to help something that I care about, something I belong to. And there's social pressures and other things that go into it. But the body basically says, I'm not syncing up with whatever this is, so it doesn't belong to me. And I hate to say the infant isn't is, but the way that their body is actually responding, it begins to kind of see it more as an object than something that belongs to them. And we could take this much further, but maybe that's sort of food for thought. But it does matter how we synchronize. It does matter how we get into alignment with others as much as we can.
Yeah, you know, it's such a fascinating way to look at human interaction. And it's really saying that when we ourselves are in a state where, you know, our hearts and mind don't align, how much it influences those around us, even without a word said.
Yep, that's exactly right. Because our brain is constantly processing information that we don't know that it's processing. And it's a good thing because it would overwhelm us. Persons with ADHD, it's an issue of a lot of information coming in and them not necessarily knowing what's the most important thing. And so our brain, again, sort of automatically, kind of as a regulatory thing, kind of picks and chooses what information is valuable or based on how we regulate, how we interact, whatever is going on, the things that we should attend to. And in states that I've talked about before, where the person that's sitting across from you is by all accounts friendly, and this is maybe the first time you're meeting him, if you're stressed out, there's a part of your brain called the insula that will, instead of relying on what is extra-receptively or externally being fed, it will just create its own version of it because the internal signal says stress, so it tells you what to see. So you start looking at every movement, every facial expression as potentially a threat. So just that small detail changes the entire conversation. And that's all mainly because we don't spend enough time with ourselves. We don't spend enough time with our body and knowing kind of what we're doing because we were so oversaturated with information. We're so overstimulated generally as a whole that it's hard for us unless we force our body to be able to focus on it, to give ourselves the space and time to focus on those things, because otherwise it's not, because everything is going to be automated. Everything is going to be done without your knowledge because you're prioritizing other things. And there's contingencies. There's a lot of reasons why you would. So your body says it doesn't make sense for you to focus on this right now because it's automated.
Yeah. You know, our time is almost up, but for our listeners, are there, you know, things that you recommend people do to increase their self-awareness about their body in a way that will help themselves feel, you know, in a better place in terms of stress or influence those around them in a maybe more positive way if they're sensing some friction?
Well, and it's hard to, you know, because to me it's individualized. That's why I'm very, you know, careful because, you know, what works at the individual level may or may not work at the group level, which is a group may not work for the individual. But I would say that, again, if you're noticing very specific types of situations that you tend to be more stressed out in, or that conversations or whatever you're trying to accomplish tends to be less successful, then stop and figure out why. Give yourself the opportunity to think about what could be going wrong. And what you're doing, as long as you're kind of being mindful too of your heart rate, your body, it will allow you to be able to, again, give your brain the opportunity to maybe try a different strategy, because if you can focus on what may be wrong, then you can focus on that one thing and try to make sure that it doesn't get out of sync. So if there's one person in the room that tends to always kind of have a negative response to you, and that response you feed off of, and therefore you begin down this kind of pathway of dysregulation or of stress, then maybe focusing on that person in a way to maybe neutralize their influence on you or the group, or maybe spending some time to directly say, look, I don't know if this is intentional, you know, but this is what's going on in the group, and this is kind of what I'm feeling. I mean, and that seems hard to do because I know there's different dynamics and situations, but that's one way. But you have to be able to identify it in yourself first. You have to be able to put your finger on it because they may or may not know that they're doing it. If you have the most stressful day ever, at a physician seeing multiple patients, multiple codes, and you go home and someone says, well, what was so stressful about today? It's actually, unless there's a major kind of sentinel event, it's actually really hard to account for all the different stressors you face because your body and brain are so used to it. So when someone asks you to identify it, it's actually pretty hard sometimes to actually say, no, this is actually probably the source of my stress. Probably because it was a lot, but you have to be able to peel back in bins first and categories, what are my stress points? And then once you peel them out of their bins, you can look at them individually and you can begin to at least try to create or interact with the world from a model that is going to put you at the advantage. And again, that there's multiple things. I mean, if you tap your foot, if you're always, you know, kind of have a nervous energy and you always feel like you have to move, well, what is that preventing from you in interactions? Are you missing information? Do you really not want to be there? Why is my body telling me to run and I'm forcing it to sit down so it needs to fidget in order to feel like it's actually doing what it wants to do? So understanding that fidget behavior is calming and grounding, but why do I want to run? Why do I want to move? What is it that's causing me to have that feeling or that thought? And again, it seems small, but that is everything, because now you can begin to understand how your body is actually interpreting the environment that it's not really telling your conscious about.
Yeah. Gosh, Chance, that is such interesting information. You know, we don't think in this way of how our body and our awareness influences us and what it's really telling us, and we're not listening to our body. So thank you so much for all this great information and all the research that you do to help us learn more about this area.
Thanks again for the questions and for the opportunity.
Thank you.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website, emoryhealthcare.org/livewell. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.